Hi, Dr. Cara Morley here for another episode in Leadership Amplified, my podcast focusing on all good things leadership. And today my focus is on inclusion and what we need to do to create better gender equality and increase inclusion. Today I'm my own guest. This is a solo cast. So what I'm doing is sharing with you the presentation that I made recently in Queensland at the Resource Industry Network International Women's Day lunch. And the focus for the presentation, which has caused some interest, is choose to challenge with compassion and empathy. And let me share with you what I had to say up in Mackay, Queensland. When I first heard the title for International Women's Day this year, the theme, Choose to Challenge, I thought, what were the International Women's Day organisers actually thinking after a year of COVID challenge? Given how challenging gender equality has been for so many years, I thought, why is it this year that we're going to be choosing to challenge? Do we need more challenge? Probably not. Couldn't we make it a bit easier? Well, in fact, a couple of years ago, I'd caught myself having similar feelings about the challenge of working in the gender diversity arena. I mean, without the COVID bit, of course. I was feeling somewhat weighed down by the feeling of challenge that was caught up with doing gender diversity work, not just as an expert, but in my daily life and working life, and some of the challenges of having conversations about gender diversity. And there was one in particular that triggered me to do something different. A CEO and HR director were tearing their hair out because one of their key leaders just wasn't on board with the CEO's diversity agenda. He was labelled a resistor. He was considered argumentative. He pushed back on everything. And they were feeling really frustrated. He had just about half the business under his control, so he was an absolutely critical stakeholder. But that exhausted their box of tricks on what to do. They didn't know what to do anymore. So they asked me to speak with him to get on board. Now, look, my immediate thought bubble was, if you can't change this guy, let's call him Bob, with the power and the authority that you both have, now how on earth am I going to do that? And then my second thought bubble was, okay, if power and authority doesn't work, what will? And look, I know this, power and authority is rarely enough to change people's minds. So I really needed to flip my mindset about challenge to something that was going to work. So I switched to coach mode. Flash of the blindingly obvious. That's my preference anyway. It takes me into empathy when I think about coaching. So instead of focusing on resistance, which was our focus up until this point, I challenged myself to understand what was going on for Bob. Now, resisting takes energy, whichever side you're on. So I thought, well, what was his challenge? What has him stuck? Why is he resisting? Why is he doing this, pushing back? So if Bob was going to come on board, we really needed to discover where Bob was now, and then create a path, that he could board from. So my mission then, more broadly in the work that I was doing in gender diversity, was to find ways to make challenging conversations so much easier. How could we flip to challenging with compassion so that we can work positively with our differences, find common ground? That's what turned into my book, Beat Gender Bias, that was released last year. That is all about how to understand what's going on with bias from a curious perspective, and helping to have constructive conversations. So back to the International Women's Day theme, and the idea that I'm sharing in the podcast is that we can flip challenge. So that choosing to challenge still feels powerful, but even more so when we challenge with compassion, and it feels so much more hopeful then for achieving gender equality. So I'm going to focus on three key areas of challenge and suggest some different ways to approach the challenges. The first is unconscious bias. The second is shifting the focus from women to gender and engaging men, which is critical. And three, changing our behaviour so that we can be more inclusive. So as I move through this, I set you the challenge, listener, of thinking about what you might choose to challenge differently, and taking in compassion and empathy for whomever, whatever you're challenging, as well as keeping some of it there for yourself. So the first of those areas is around the bias in our brains and how it causes gender blind spots for us. Now, the concept of unconscious bias has been a huge breakthrough, and it's allowed us to engage quite differently, I think, with gender stereotypes. Look, it's not without its detractors, but there remains a definitely huge value in understanding more about it and how it works, because think about this, it is seriously challenging to think that we can disagree with ourselves, even with our most strongly held beliefs, and we have no idea that we do. That just sums up unconscious bias for me. You know, we've got a complicated relationship with ourselves and with our own thinking, let alone with people who are different from us. And even those of us who do believe deeply in gender equality can make biased decisions from time to time. We're not perfect. We're not over it. Men and women have these unconscious associations, and bias isn't something that men do to women. It's something that we all might do. And unfortunately, I'm living proof of that. You know, I flew recently, and you know, when I was walking along the airport concourse, I saw two pilots walking side by side to the gate. There was a significant height difference between them. And before I knew what I was thinking, this thought popped into my head. She can't be a pilot. She's not strong enough. Whoa, what is going on? I do not believe that. I disagree with myself. You know, the thought had bubbled up from my unconscious associations that I don't agree with. And there it was in my mind before I was even aware of thinking it. And it is when we're on automatic pilot, if you'll forgive the pun, when we feel most certain and when we know, that we're most likely to make biased decisions like this. We can pull ourselves up, as I did, but we don't always notice it, so we don't. Having a conversation about unconscious bias can sometimes seem a bit like a military obstacle course. You can expect the ground is going to come out from you over here, something's going to explode over there, and you'll fall flat on the face or get caught in the ropes. I got to thinking about how can we remove these obstacles? How can we make it easier to at least talk about bias and the potential for bias with a degree of openness, without shame or guilt or any need to be perfect? You know, how we show up in conversations makes a really big difference. So the place to start is with curiosity. You know, if you enter a state of curiosity, decide to be curious, you'll trigger a burst of dopamine, and that feels good. Dopamine's a bit of a wonder drug, completely legal, free, and it's also very good for you. In a way, it's a bit of an armor that you can take into conversations. The best way to harness curiosity in conversations is to ask open questions. You know, what do you think? What haven't we thought of? How did that happen? What might we do differently? What's another way to see this? You know, that's easy. They're simple questions that we know how to ask. And open questions have the great value of keeping you feeling curious, and that triggers curiosity in others. So it becomes contagious. If you're feeling curious, exploring ideas, exchanging views, it feels good. And that increases the likelihood that the conversation is going to be a positive one, and one that the people engaged in it feel is rewarding. And then, of course, they'll be more likely to say yes to future conversations. So there's a little snowball happening here. We know how important continuing conversations is. Gender equality wasn't built in a day. We need to keep having the conversations. We need to keep making change, making progress, keeping the momentum up. So be curious and ask questions. The second thing that I think is really important in terms of how we show up in conversations is to find a way to increase our candor. Now, starting with curiosity helps frame the conversation in a positive way, and we can then listen to different views with a more open mind. And encouraging candor in conversations about diversity is becoming increasingly important, and dare I say, perhaps a little more difficult. But we must welcome all views into the conversation. We need to have safer places, where we can talk about what we disagree on, what feels uncomfortable. You know, I just don't get that. We can't have people being burned for expressing their views. Now, you know, we need to be respectful. We need to both share and listen to views. But how are we going to bridge differences and work together if we don't encourage people to express their views? You know, the folly really is that if we suppress a negative or an alternative view, it doesn't just make it go away. It doesn't just disappear. Actually, it magnifies. It gets stronger. So there's quite a bit of research. This was one of the ways they were trying to overcome unconscious bias in the earlier days of the research. And what they found was that after attempts at suppressing the beliefs, bias decisions actually increase, and we so don't need that. We don't want people to sit on it. We can't work with it if we don't know what we all think. We need people to say what they mean and to express themselves. Gender inclusion in general, isn't about one right way. It's about letting 1,000 ideas flourish so that we can all benefit from the wonderful ideas and the richness of the differences that we bring. That's the diversity dividend. Now, finally, confidentiality is really important. We need to be respectful when people have been candid. We need to keep a cone of silence around people's disclosures and those differences of opinion. That respectfully keeping confidences is really important. I don't think we pay enough attention to that in our conversations. When people are sharing contentious or unpopular views, saying what they think, they need to know that they can trust that it stays in the room. We don't want people's honesty and candor to be used against them. I certainly don't want to be honest and open and open up to being more candid and then have it come back to bite me later. We really need to honor confidentiality. So I talk about these three things, curiosity, candor, and confidentiality, as commitments. If we commit collectively to this, we can have richer conversations. So this might be one way in which you can challenge yourself with compassion and empathy and others as well, and think differently about how you set up more meaningful conversations about bias and the potential for bias. The second area that I'm going to focus on is why women and men together should champion change. Now, I happen to be sharing the conversation commitments with Andrew, who's an executive in an organization. We were planning an unconscious bias workshop for his executive team and going through, you know, the agenda for that. When I shared the commitments, it had an immediate effect in the conversation. I got to candor and Andrew dived right in and he decided to be candid then and there. And what he shared with me was that he and his male colleagues in the lead up to this workshop have been having discussions and they said that we feel like we're walking on eggshells when we have conversations about gender. We're not sure what we should say. We're worried about saying the wrong thing. We don't want to offend the women in the room. Now, I'll be honest, my background thought bubble as he was saying this was, what do you mean? You feel like you're walking on eggshells. That's what we women feel like all the time. But then it really got me thinking, what if there is this reservoir of goodwill out there and we're just not tapping it? What if there's a whole bunch of men out there who are already supportive, who'd be in the game, but they just don't know what to say and how to get themselves into the game. They don't know how to talk about it or what to do. this idea that equality is women's business and men don't want to interfere needs a rethink for both men and women. So maybe we can clean up some of those eggshells and have some better conversations. You know, gender equality just is not something that women can achieve on our own. We've separated out gender roles. We've split what's possible to be human into two. We've got humanity in half. If you're a woman, you can be warm, kind, caring. If you're a man, you can be agentic, dominant, commanding, bold. I mean, how limiting is that? We've got these prescriptions that say we can only be half of what's humanly possible. It doesn't make any sense to me. Women can be strong and warm. Men can be warm and strong. You know, when we're all able to flex our sort of strengths and our preferences across the full range of human behaviour, we'll all be much better humans. I think that's something really worth aspiring to. But when it comes to championing change, we need to do the heavy lifting together. You know, it's true that not all women are concerned with gender equality, and we should not expect them to be. We're not all the same. We need to make it easier to include men in the conversation, to welcome them in, to expect that they'll be in it. And if they want to, then they can take up the invitation. Going back to my earlier example of Bob, we did meet up and I put myself into coach mode. So I started by asking him what his concerns were. And then I just let him speak to his concerns for a while and didn't interrupt. I accepted and validated his view in terms of what he was saying. And what I learned from listening to him was that his big concern was that if there was a quota or target, which wasn't necessarily on the agenda, he wouldn't be able to meet it. It wasn't equality that he was worried about. That was what I discovered from the conversation. His worry was about meeting targets, and those targets hadn't even been set. So I asked him then if he had a why, a sense of purpose for gender diversity, why the organisation should do it, what would make it possible for him to sign up to a purpose for gender diversity, what would it be? And he could articulate one. And then I followed that up and asked him what his experience of diversity had been, to tell me about a time in his career, if he'd worked in a diverse team and what it felt like. He just floored me. He had the most amazing example, and he became really animated as he shared the story. I felt immediately engaged and inspired in his story. He talked about one instance of working in a diverse team that had been his best team experience ever. It was a real turning point, not just in the conversation, but for him. He was able to flip his engagement. He started sharing the story with others. He told it absolutely superbly, and it became inspiring to others. So he had these strong beliefs and this powerful experience that were being kind of squashed and crushed and not even getting into the agenda just because of the conversation and how everybody was engaging around it. By making it personal to him and achievable, he was able to go on to become a champion for gender equality and inclusion, and his CEO describes him like that now. And one of the tools that I like to use is a pipeline or a continuum concept, and that maps out where stakeholders, and particularly men, are. And it's a way to identify what might be going on for them and how can I go about enlisting their support. And for me, this is empathy on a slightly larger scale. So the pipeline goes from resistor to skeptic to bystander to supporter to champion, from fully negative up to fully positive. You know, we tend to get preoccupied with the outer ends, and it's not that we shouldn't pay them any attention, but I think by far the biggest opportunity comes for us from working and engaging with those in the middle, and that's the group that I call the bystanders. Now, if you think about a bell-shaped curve of the population, about 60% of people are in the middle, pretty much, typically. This is what is referred to as the marvelous movable middle. And I think that if we focus on this 60% of men being in the middle, what works for them is they need to know what's expected of them, and they need to be shown how to get involved and what to say and what to do. And they'll be more supportive when they see other men being supportive. So if they can see male supporters around them, then they will know what to do. They'll see what's possible. They know how to get in the game. And the Male Champions of Change is based on this premise, and it does it really well. We tend to think of affinity bias as unhelpful, which it often is, because it can exclude people too often. But it can also play a positive part. We can harness the value of affinity bias to increase our equality by encouraging people like you and finding people like you, and helping them to speak up and showing them how to do it. So in terms of challenging yourself, what is something that you might be able to do to hook into that marvelous movable middle? Who in your network sits there? And how might you be able to engage them with compassion, of course, and get them to be more supportive of gender equality? To the final area now, and this is six ways to be inclusive. Two of these focus on how you might increase your curiosity to be more inclusive. Two focus on how you might increase your candor to be more inclusive. And then there are another two that I've put in just for good measure. So when you think about these, my suggestion is not to think about being inclusive in six more ways, but really to find the one that might resonate you, that you can include in your own repertoire for inclusive leadership. To prime curiosity first up, a key thing to do is to accept that you're not fair. Now, this is super challenging because basically we all do believe that we are fair. It's like being honest. It goes without saying, of course I am. But if you can use your curiosity to accept that the world isn't fair, we humans aren't innately fair, and I'm not always fair either, as much as I might try to be. It's one of the strange ways in which bias works. If we believe the world's fair, we reduce our awareness of different people's experience of the world. Demographic differences mean that people are treated differently. There isn't a level playing field. And so if you accept that and then accept that you're part of the playing field and that you're not fair, it helps to counteract that. One of the best bias busters is to be less certain, to entertain reasonable doubt, and to be curious about just how far you are. And when you do that, you're more likely to make fairer decisions. The second area to extend your curiosity and that acceptance that maybe you're not entirely fair all the time is to then be able to notice your bias. Before you worry about anybody else's bias, start by focusing on your own. This was a challenge that I set to myself. It kind of hadn't occurred to me before this, but when I started thinking about how to be more compassionate and have more empathy, I thought I needed to do all of that by starting with myself. Now, in her book, The Loudest Duck, diversity advocate Laura Liswood talks about the hypervigilance that minority group members feel compared with the oblivion that many majority group members experience. So, you know, if you're part of the elephant herd, you just have no idea that there's a mouse in the room. You just don't need to. But if you're the mouse in the room, oh yes, you certainly notice the elephants. You know exactly where they are and become hypervigilant. Now, our biases are working all the time in terms of what we're paying attention to. And they affect really tiny things like whether we notice people, whether we make eye contact with them, whether we smile or frown. Not very visible behaviours, but they're important data and we're always giving and receiving it. You know, this affects our behaviour. So it builds into what we say, how we say it, who we say it to, how long we spend with others, how much effort we'll put into understanding them, whether we promote them into particular roles. Managers, both male and female, spend more time with male team members and their conversations are more focused on their careers. Plus, they give them more actionable feedback. So men get more actionable feedback than women do. So if you can get a bit micro and notice yourself in some of these small behaviors, you can collect some data on your own interactions. Who are you spending time with? What are you talking about? You can notice yourself and then you can question what's going on. Remember to be compassionate. The third of the six areas, which is now about candor, is to call it out. This is my take on that. That kind of expression is getting a lot of airplay, but I'm focusing here on three main pinch points in conversations that many women experience, and we all need to make sure these are called out. The speaking up bind means that women are encouraged to speak up, to be more confident, but then they're penalized when they do. You talk too much or you're too aggressive. Repeating with an H for he. Jill raises an idea. John repeats it. He peeps it. 10 minutes later, we think John is a genius. We need to be able to notice when Jill raises the idea and attribute it to her and see her as the genius. Displays of dominance can crowd women out in particular, talking too much, too loudly, big gestures, interrupting others. That all gets in the way of women being able to show up in conversations. So we can bring in the curiosity, candor, commit, the confidentiality commitments to help have safe conversations. And it's a great starting point. When you've got that as a foundation, it gives everyone permission to ask what's happening in our conversation. How do we go when we just had that discussion? And we can also focus on creating collective intelligence, which really means we manage equal airtime. Everybody gets their say. We go around the room so that we're taking turns and we're acknowledging everyone's contributions. That means that everyone gets to contribute their best ideas. And when teams work off the basis of collective intelligence, they outperform teams with even smarter people in them. Now, you can call yourself out, and especially I encourage you to do that if you're the person who has the greatest status in the room. And you can ask yourself some questions about this that didn't seem to go well. I'd like to know what I can do better next time. What am I not noticing here that's obvious to others? You can say, I feel out of my depth. What should we do? So there are lots of opportunities for calling yourself out. The fourth area is, if it's personal, call it in. There are times when we do need to call it in rather than call it out. And this is an idea that comes from Professor Loretta J. Ross. She says that calling it in involves taking someone aside, having a private conversation and letting them know what bothers you, giving them feedback and doing that with a dose of compassion. Because there are times when we're going to call it out, and if we do it publicly and we're not using all of our emotional intelligence, let's say, in the moment, we can create a sense of threat and of shame, and that only pushes people away. People end up feeling alienated and disengaged. We're not ignoring harm, slight damage, the potential for it, but we're also not exaggerating it and making it everything. And calling it in means that you always keep a seat at the table. So even if people decide they don't want to be part of this or it's not for them, make it so that they can come back later. They can come back to the conversation. And men, I think in particular, women really need you to be calling in and calling out disrespectful behavior towards women. Women can't do this anywhere near as effectively as men can. You can do that with your peers. You can take them aside. You can tell them what you notice and you can ask them to show up differently. The fifth of my six areas is to listen to multiple perspectives. Time pressures really get in the way of this. As we're busier and busier, this gets harder and harder to do. When you think you know, explicitly check for views that might contradict you. Once an unconscious association has been activated, we tend to only seek out information that confirms it, the confirmation bias. So we need to make sure that as a practice to counteract confirmation bias and the possibility that our biases might be activated and we don't know it, seek contradictory views and get multiple ideas. You know, give yourself a target of getting three views before you make an important decision. Finally, number six, check your privilege. And I wanted to speak about this because there's been quite a lot of conversation about checking your privilege, particularly over the last year. And I think there are some ways that is actually backfiring. So I wanted to talk about how checking your privilege kind of works and how we can make it work effectively. Certainly, acknowledging privilege does help us to have more empathy for people who are experiencing disadvantage. But the challenge is that we don't judge group disadvantage in the same way that we judge personal disadvantage. It's just not that simple. So if someone tells you you're privileged, then there's a high likelihood that that's going to backfire, because what you will do is to move to defend your lack of privilege. You will underplay any privilege you have and overplay the lack of privilege and how much hard work it's taken you to get what you want. If we're told we're privileged, we're more likely to emphasize ways in which we're not privileged. And that's because this is kind of about hooks into our self-esteem. We don't want to be seen as undeserving. We will fear that others see our privileges unearned. And in a sense, we want to dissociate ourselves from that. There's an interesting research example where people who use family connections to get a job didn't see that as an advantage at all. They believe that they won the job on merit. Now, those very same people were then told about someone else who used family connections to get their job. Now, these people saw them as benefiting from advantage and they judged them as being less qualified. So it's one rule for me and one rule for you. So we need to take this into account. There are two things that you can do to overcome this effect. Firstly, you can reflect on your values, remind yourself of the important values that you hold, fairness, for inclusion, for bringing out creative ideas. And or you can also reflect on your own personal successes and what you've achieved. If you do these two things, then you're much more open then to go on and think about disadvantage that others might experience. You can encourage this in others too. So instead of saying to somebody, oh, you should recognize your privilege, talk about their values. Get them involved in a conversation about what they value and what they hold to be particularly important around people and fairness, etc. And also, you can talk with them about their own successes and get them to tell their story about their success. Then, once that's done, you can talk about group advantage and disadvantage. By doing these couple of things, people are more easily able to access their empathy, and then there's more openness to having a conversation and getting involved in seeing the disadvantages that other people face. So think about, out of these six particular ways to be more inclusive, whether there's anything that strikes you or something that you might like to include in your own repertoire. So what I focused on in this solo cast is three things, but one main thing above all of that, and that is that let's spend this year choosing to challenge, and let's do it with compassion and with empathy, so that we can inspire hope. When it comes to unconscious bias, we can challenge that by setting up conversational commitments that mean you can have different conversations, that you can cover off on the potential for bias, and you can do that in a way where you continue to have those constructive conversations together. The second, focus area in terms of challenge is encouraging more men to get involved, help them to find their why, to find their story about diversity, and to make it easy to move them from the middle up into being supporters and champions by giving them tangible things to do. And finally, you can be inclusive using, in particular, curiosity and candor. And there are a number of things that you can do that are very practical day-to-day sorts of activities. So thank you so much for listening to another episode of Leadership Amplified. As your host, Karen Morley, it's been a delight to have you listening in today. And good luck for this year, where our focus is on choosing to challenge and doing that with compassion and empathy to inspire hope that gender equality progress can be sped up and we can get to 50-50 sooner rather than later.